on to third case of the morning. William Perrios et al. Versus United States. Brown.
Please the court. My name is Tom Brown, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Mancarius, Mr. Murphy. I was trial counsel for Mr. Mancarius in the underlying trial. I truly believe that, having done this for a number of years, that the thing that I might be able to do to provide information to the court that's not necessarily adequately provided for in the briefs, because I think the law is pretty well stated in the briefs and is I won't say it's self-evident because I think there's some controversy, but I think that it's well stated there. But I'd like to try to bring, if I can, some practicality to what effect what we have alleged was an error that occurred would have had on the trial. Under the Netter premise, you have to go through, as people who collaterally attack their convictions in the criminal area all have to do, you have to go through whether you waived it, you have to go through whether it's retroactive, and then if you get past those two hurdles, you have to determine whether or not the error was harmless, either beyond a reasonable doubt or whether there's at least a grave doubt as to whether the error was harmless. And it's that I'd like to talk to you about a little bit this morning, because, again, I was there, you weren't. I know Judge Evans has some knowledge of this case because when he was a district court judge, he sentenced Mr. Green, who was one of the people who testified for the government in this case. So he has perhaps more knowledge than would be typical at this level.
We also had heard the original appeal.
He certainly did, and he issued a difficult decision for me and for my clients, at least. So he does. I understand that. But the important thing here, I think, is this. This was a case, if there ever was a case, about false invoices. This was a case that there were two people who testified to two separate frauds. I used to call it the coloring book case, because it was Mr. Brown and Mr. Green were the two people who testified. And Mr. Brown and Mr. Green really both testified, and really it was clear that there were false invoices. It's true that Mr. Brown's part of the case, which resolved around his supposedly inflating invoices, that the defense that was put on was no, the invoices weren't inflated because the work that was done was appropriately charged.
And what was the argument at trial that the false invoices were not part of a scheme?
The argument at trial...
That to deny any involvement with false invoices at all?
Well, no. In the Ed Brown part of the case, Your Honor, the argument was that the invoices were not false in terms of them being bumped.
There was no fraud, wasn't it?
The argument was that there was a fraud, but it was a fraud being committed by Mr. Brown against his co-owners of his company.
And with Mancarius and the other one not involved at all, that they were not parties to any fraud that was going on.
That's correct. That they believed, their defense was, that they believed that the invoices that they received were invoices that were for work that was performed and were appropriate invoices.
Well, let me just ask you about this. The government seems to be arguing that the defense at trial that no fraud existed, and your now proposed defense that the fraud was not material, are mutually exclusive.
That's certainly their argument. That certainly is their argument. I respectfully disagree. And I disagree because I think you can put on a defense that says we did not involve ourselves in fraudulent invoices. The government has now established stuff that doesn't pass the smell test. Why were there invoices for third parties that were bogus, for purveyors of supposed work that didn't exist, or for checks that were cashed at a bar? All of those things don't pass the smell test, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is that if this jury had the opportunity to hear about a materiality instruction, it would have in fact dovetailed precisely with part of our defense. Our defense was the crook here was Ed Brown. Mr. Brown was defrauding his co-owners. And all of the reasons that these invoices were inappropriate would have fit exactly within that same kind of a theory. that the defendants, Mr. Mancarius and Mr. Murphy, were not aware of this fraudulent activity, but in any event, even if you believe that fraudulent activity occurred, it was not material to a charge against Mancarius and Murphy, it was material to a charge against Mr. Brown. He's the bad guy. That was the argument, and I don't believe they're mutually exclusive. I can understand how on its face that sounds to be the case, Your Honor. But I don't believe, having been there and having tried the case, that those were mutually exclusive. A tremendous amount of effort was put in to attempt to prove that Mr. Brown had defrauded his co-owners. And all of that was allowed in as impeachment, and certainly the jury could have decided not to believe Mr. Brown, and they did, in fairness, obviously, or they couldn't have convicted Mr. Mancarius and Mr. Murphy. What I'm trying to say here is, had there been this additional element of the jury being told that there had that these false statements that they found were false had to be material to Mancarius and Murphy, there was an alternate theory that jury could have arrived at a conclusion that was consistent with innocence rather than a conclusion that was required guilt.
I preface this question by saying that your reputation as one of the outstanding lawyers in the state and certainly in the Milwaukee community. What prevented you from raising that alternative materiality argument if that was really going to be a legitimate issue?
Well, Judge, if you don't believe that that's an issue for the jury, which is what the law was at the time, and that you're not going to get an instruction, then I believe you have to make the general defense that we made, which was he was a crook. I believe we did raise this defense, Judge. I believe we did, in fact, put before the jury an alternative theory that indicated that they were wrong.
You admit here that materiality was never really raised as an issue. I mean, nobody said, we want a jury instruction on this. This is an important point in the trial, Judge. We want to argue about materiality. That was never said or done, but under this theory that we are now that you're now advancing, that could have been done.
It certainly could have, Judge. And I guess the only answer I can give you is, given the prospect of what the law was as I understood it at that time, without a jury instruction to tell the jury that these false statements must be material to Mancarius and Murphy, that specific argument wasn't made. And I believe it was because that was what the law was at the time. But the important question is Judge Randa and now this court needs to look at this record and it needs to satisfy itself that it wouldn't have made any difference, that with a materiality instruction it wouldn't make any difference. And I understand your question. You're saying, well, if you thought it was going to make such a big difference, Brown, why didn't you raise it at the time of the trial? And all I can answer to that is that at the time of the trial, there was absolutely no provision in the Seventh Circuit law that was a jury issue. If it was any issue, it was an issue for the judge. And even that wasn't altogether clear in terms of mail fraud and wire fraud, and therefore, by virtue of mail fraud and wire fraud, money laundering, which is what we have in this case. It simply wasn't the law, and the tactical decision that was made at the time, I guess, was that without the benefit of a jury instruction, it just wasn't a worthwhile defense that was able to be at least directed to the jury's attention, if you will, by an instruction.
But in reality, haven't you already argued materiality by arguing that their participation was zero?
I believe we did, Judge, but what we didn't get is we didn't get an instruction from the person wearing the black robe telling the jury, you've got to make a decision about this. You heard these arguments, you heard this evidence, and one of the things that you have to decide beyond a reasonable doubt is whether, in fact, these things that don't pass the smell test were part of Mr. Brown's own scheme and Mr. Green's own scheme, or whether they were part of a scheme involving Mancarius and Murphy.
Are you arguing that it was error to fail to instruct on materiality at that time? It couldn't be.
I'm arguing that it wasn't error at that time because that was not the law, Judge. I'm arguing that under Netter, it is the law now, and I'm arguing that I believe what the district court judge did in this case was to say, okay, then what I have to do is review the evidence and decide whether And I'm going to concede, we argued that it was beyond a reasonable doubt. I think it's probably a grave doubt. I'm not sure if that's a distinction with a difference or not. But in any event, Judge Randa determined, based on the evidence, that it didn't raise a grave doubt because he didn't believe materiality was a real issue in the case. And I'm just here to tell you that I'm respectfully disagreeing with this, with that conclusion, as the person who fought the battle. And I think that there's ample evidence in this record to demonstrate that that was how the battle was waged, at least in part.
What would be the reason for construing Netter to be applicable to collateral review? What would be the logic?
I think, Judge, that the Second Circuit addressed that issue. I think it's the only circuit that's addressed that issue in terms of whether that ought to be retroactive on collateral review. And I think what the Second Circuit decided in the Ali case was that when you have conduct which was essentially not illegal before the change, that kind of conduct, that kind of a ruling, therefore, is a substantive change in the criminal law. It's not a procedural change. And importantly, the Second Circuit, after Ali, analyzed it in a situation where there was a case where the judge in fact made a finding of materiality but used a preponderance of the evidence. And the court in that case said, well, when that happens, that's really a change in procedure and that ought not to be retroactive and available for collateral review. But when it's changed in substantive law, you're basically taking something that wasn't illegal and making it illegal.
But if our construction of like Apprendi issues, we have not made a statement that that's applicable to collateral review. And it would seem that's even a stronger case for making it applicable to collateral review than the rule in Netter.
But I certainly can see the logic of that, Judge. I mean, I understand that it's pretty hard to argue that when you haven't been adequately charged with something in the indictment and put on notice of it, that that's pretty fundamental. I guess all I can say to you is that when I never thought I'd say this, but when you read Judge Scalia's dissent in Netter, I think it really brings home the fact that, at least in Judge Scalia's view, Netter came to the wrong conclusion. Judge Scalia believed that Netter should have said everybody's case should get reversed, period. There shouldn't be this review for harmless error, because he found this is a change in the substantive law. And obviously that's not the rule, because that's not what the Netter decision turned out to be, but I think it's indicative of this court looking at it and saying, is this the kind of change in the law that ought to be attackable under collateral review, under collateral review and retroactive, because it's basically saying that an element that never existed before now exists. Or at least the court said, maybe the court said it really always existed, but it was never recognized before, and their position is you have to prove that. Well, I don't know how much more basic you can get than an essential element of an offense not being proven and or not being instructed on, at least in terms of the jury. I guess I'll reserve my rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. O'Neill?
May it please the Court. My name is Erica O'Neill, and I represent the United States. As Mr. Brown noted, he has a slight advantage here. I did not represent the United States in the case below or in the underlying criminal case, so my knowledge of this case is obviously much less than his. However, I will attempt, to the best of my ability, to address his arguments regarding cause. However, first, there's a couple of very important points I'd like to bring up. I don't believe this Court even has to get to the issue, I'm sorry, not of cause, but of prejudice, whether these defendants were prejudiced. On the first issue, there's the Teague issue. The government acknowledges that it did waive the Teague issue below. However, that does not mean that this court does not have the opportunity to invoke Teague and agree with the other courts that have decided this issue that Netter is not applicable on collateral review. There are several reasons for this. First of all, contrary to petitioner's argument, this is not a change in the substantive law. When I say this, I'm referring to Netter. Yes, Netter says that materiality is an element of the offense. However, Seventh Circuit case law, as discussed by Judge Posner in the Kaufman case, at or about the time of this trial, stated that, yes, materiality is an element of the offense, but in the Seventh Circuit, at least, that materiality instruction does not need to be given separately. It is incorporated into the fraud instruction. Therefore, the part of Netter that is a change here is a procedural change for the Seventh Circuit. It is saying that the court needs to instruct on materiality separately, not that it can be simply incorporated into the fraud instruction. Thus, this is a change in the procedural law for the Seventh Circuit, not the substantive law. As a result, we continue down the Teague analysis. It does not fall under either of the exceptions of Teague. And Teague is such that even if I were to have forgotten this issue, this court could raise it sua sponte. It is not jurisdictional, but it is a threshold question and the first step in reviewing a habeas case. If, however, this court determines that the government's waiver of Teague below binds us to going straight to the cause and prejudice analysis, petitioners in this case have not shown cause for raising this issue before the district court. They cite the Myers case, stating that the fact that the law would have been futile shows cause. However, the Myers case, as cited by the petitioners, was reversed and remanded by the Supreme Court for reconsideration based on United States versus Frady and Engle versus Isaac. On remand, the Ninth Circuit said that there is a difference between arguing law that would have been futile and law that the appellant couldn't possibly have known about. They said in the Myers case, the appellant couldn't possibly have known about it. It was an issue related to Winship that was 10 years before Winship. Here, though, this is not law that the petitioners could not possibly have known about. This was an issue that was being raised all over the place, I guess is the best way I can say it, for several years before that. As Judge Posner noted in the Kaufman decision, the Ninth Circuit, since 1981, has been requiring a separate materiality instruction for mail fraud and wire fraud. And indeed, the Godin case and the Ali case, both before Nader, brought up the issue of materiality within fraud. This was not a new issue. That the petitioner's argument would not have been popular with the district court or the Seventh Circuit does not mean that it was futile, and therefore the petitioners have not shown cause. Turning next to the prejudice argument, as I stated, this is where I am at a bit of a disadvantage. However, I am, frankly, still somewhat confused by the petitioner's argument. They are arguing that the trial tack that they could have now taken was that the fraud was not material to Delta. However, as charged in the indictment, Mancarius and Murphy instructed Brown and Green to create fraudulent invoices. Mancarius and Murphy then caused Delta to pay these invoices, and they took kickbacks on those invoices from Brown and Green separately. That's all well and good if Brown was the crook, but as soon as Mancarius and Murphy caused Delta to pay those fraudulent invoices, the fraud became material to Delta. And the argument that Mancarius and Murphy were not aware of the fraudulent activity by Brown and Green was explicitly rejected by the jury in this case. In the jury instructions, in order to find Mancarius and Murphy guilty, the jury had to find that the defendants knowingly participated in a scheme to defraud or obtain money, and that the defendants, in the third part of the instruction, did so knowingly with the intent to defraud. They're still arguing that Mancarius and Murphy were not aware, were not involved. However, that does not comport with what the jury had to find Mancarius and Murphy guilty. For that reason, I simply am confused about the prejudice and how petitioners can attempt to draw this distinction, which to me is a distinction without a difference, regarding fraudulent activity material to Delta and fraudulent activity that is simply material to Brown and Green and their companies. If the court does not have any questions for me on this issue or on the Condon or New Trial Rule 33 issues, The government wishes to simply rest on its written submissions and ask to be excused.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Brian?
The reason for the confusion is probably the messenger. And I guess all I can say is this. I think there's a difference between a fraud against Delta and awareness of a fraud against Delta. When I said that Mancarius and Murphy's position at trial was that they believed that the invoices were legitimate as it related to Delta, that was the defense in the case. The fact that Mr. Green may have wanted to defraud his cohorts at his company and wanted to get money out of his company, and that Mancarius and Murphy were aware of that, and that Mancarius and Murphy participated in paying for invoices that said that there were fireworks when there were no fireworks, and everybody on God's green earth knew that there were no fireworks, that's the distinction. If the purpose of doing that payment of those knowingly false invoices was to get money out of Delta and get a kickback to them, that clearly was material to a fraud against them. If the purpose was to help Mr. Green get money out of his company so he could defraud his wife and his cohorts, then that was a material fraud and misrepresentation that was not relevant to the charge against Mancarius and Murphy. And that, I believe, is the difference. The argument in terms of the indictment, I think, probably speaks well.
What would have been the motivation for Mancarius and Murphy to be involved in something like that? They were not getting.
They were going to make a fortune with this guy, Judge. I mean, the point was, and you remember Mr. Green. Mr. Green was going around the whole aluminum smelting business around the country saying, I have the in with all the big users of aluminum, and I've got exclusive contracts with them, and if you hitch your star to my wagon, I'll get you in the door at Emerson Electric and GE and all of these big users of aluminum, and you'll get good prices and you'll make money. Now, someone in that situation sometimes closes their eyes, looks the other way, helps somebody to commit a fraud against someone else if that's what their ticket to stardom is. And, you know, that, again, was part of what was, in fact, factually tried in this case. And so, granted, normally you would say, well, why would you help somebody cheat their spouse out of thousands of dollars? And the answer I suggest to you is, if that was what was needed in order to be able to make money, and they thought they were going to make money, that's what they did. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Case be taken under advisement.